Good afternoon. And before we start, I want you all to stand up. Everybody. Up, 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 up. Right. I want you to think very carefully now. If you've never been in a project that hasn't screwed up somewhere along the line, will you please sit down? So nobody has been in a project that hasn't screwed up. This is my sort of audience. You can all sit down now. So, and that's sort of what we're going to be talking about a little bit today, the various things that can unfortunately go wrong. We'll introduce ourselves in a bit more detail going on, but we'll have a quick look at the agenda. The introduction, the structure that we're going to deliver this afternoon in, which is going to be in three sections, and then those specific sections, which are technical worst practices, deployment worst practices, and organizational worst practices. Strictly questions and answers at the end, and if you don't go to the microphone, we won't hear you and nor will the recording, so they'll all be on the microphone, okay? Because some people might even want to watch this online afterwards. And then there's some other sessions, and then we all go to the party and get extremely blitzed tonight. The conspirators that are standing here today. First of all, I would like this gentleman here, who most of you will know, but he will introduce himself to you.
Okay, my name is Brian Smith. I'm a senior escalation engineer for Microsoft. So I'm the guy that you don't want to be speaking to, but you probably do need to speak to if it gets really messy. I've been in support for just over 9 years with Microsoft for 11 years. I enjoy photography and walking, so you probably, if you've sort of seen my photos changing on the blog occasionally, I need to change that one actually, it's getting a bit stale. And I think I've attended every project conference and delivered sessions at almost all of them. Back when it was the project technical briefing, anybody go to the PTBs? Yep, there's a few hands up there for the PTBs. I'm not quite sure where the big heart comes from, but you know, I'm a bit like, in support, I feel I'm sometimes a little bit like House. You know, I'm sort of more interested in the problem than the customers, but you know, I'm not really. Okay, so that's me. Over to Peter.
Yes, and hello to all of you. First of all, I have a bit of a sore throat, so I hope you can all hear me, even though it's kind of rusty. My name is Peter, and I am a project MVP, and at the same time, I'm also running the company called Projectum, who's a PPM partner in Denmark. We've been in business for the last 10 years, and I've been working with Project for the last 11 years. My experience is primarily on the business side, but also obviously on the technical side, but it's both worlds, actually. And for the last year or so, I've been very focused on the innovation part of doing project management, portfolio management, and capturing ideas, which is something that Project has to offer as well for the moment. Yeah, I think that's kind of like my brief intro. Ian?
And just to say, there's still lots of spaces here that you guys don't have to stand up at the back. There's loads of spaces, so please come forward and sit down. So that's me, Ian White. I'm the old guy amongst the three, and it's great to be in an industry where actually old means experience, and so there is some value in it. I still don't feel like I'm ready to get into my rocking chair quite yet. I've delivered sessions at the SharePoint conference, European Project Conference, and many others. And when it says there, from paper tape to solid state, that is true. That's my first experience was with paper tape. I look after projects and Visio across Western Europe, which strangely doesn't include France, Germany, or the UK. But I cover from Finland in the north to Portugal in the south, which is where I'll be in a couple of weeks' time in the nice warmth that's there. At which point in time, that's us, the three of us, we need to push on. And Brian's now going to deliver his part of this.
So I want to start off with some...
You're not on.
I want to start off with some technical worst practices. Some of these I hope won't conflict with any of the other sessions if you've seen any of my previous sessions. Some overlap a little bit, and I did promise to give an answer to a question that was asked in the last session at this session, so if you came along to hear the answer to that, you should get it. Hopefully I won't forget that one. And the kind of things I'm going to go through are the technical worst practices, database maintenance or lack of it, read the manual or TechNet or books or blogs or whatever you can find to help you with the information there. Custom fields, which was the question from the well, it's the answer to the previous question because I didn't actually say what the on the published side what the potential issues could be with long publishes, but custom fields I'll be talking about. Help us to help you. I covered that a little bit in the last session, so apologies if we're going into a little bit more detail for those of you that were at that one as well. And unpublishing tasks, use it or lose it. Patching, so control the client version. Number of times that we see customers that run into problems and we fix them years ago sometimes, but somebody's got a new laptop and the new laptop's got RTM version of Project on it and they've found a bug that they had forgotten about, had fond memories of, but it came back again. And then the last thing, planning. Do we need to plan things? So database maintenance, what's the symptoms? Everything is just so slow. And without maintenance, it's like your car. The database isn't going to run as efficiently as it can. And everything in Project and SharePoint is really sort of pulling stuff from the database most of the time. Some of it's getting cached somewhere else, so the database isn't getting hit all the time. But if your project center is slow to load, then that could be the database. If your publishing is slow, then that could be the database. So keeping the database running well is sort of key to keeping Project running well as well. The biggest problem we tend to see is index fragmentation. And we've seen some customers that have got such active systems that they're actually running their sort of defragmentation scripts every night. And sometimes they're totally rebuilding the databases. Sometimes they're just sort of re-indexing. Key thing there, 70% fill factor. And I've got some diagrams just to help explain how that all works. But we don't set that in our index definitions. And I've had a few sort of angry DBAs saying, well, if we're supposed to use a 70% fill factor, why don't you specify that in the sprocs that build and create the databases? And then we've got other DBAs that would probably say exactly the opposite and don't tell us how to set our index fragmentation because we don't want to waste space. So, rock and a hard place. I'll show some diagrams why it happens, but basically indexes sort of fit into a sort of page of memory and then you get a new one to fit in and you've got to fit it somewhere in there. It fits in the middle and it splits the page into two. So that takes time. So that can cause problems. You then get your index is spread all over the place. It's very difficult to find the data if it's got to go and look through indexes that are sort of chunked up into lots of little bits. It does get better in 2013. I'll show you some of the work we've done there. And also updating statistics. In database terms, the statistics are what help the queries to understand how they should best be executed. Whether the indexes make sense to use, do I just sort of look through this whole table to find the thing that I'm looking for. The statistics aren't up to date, then it makes the wrong decision. And it might start doing a table scan, which basically means I'm going to read every row, when really it could just look at the index, find where it needed to get to, and go straight there.
Brian, what's the worst that you've seen? Put him on the spot.
Certainly up into the sort of 90% fragmented sort of...
90% fragmented, guys. Think about that.
So, normally when it gets above 20, 30%, you'll start thinking about defragging. But you might want to go even lower than that in some of the tables. But certainly when it gets up to 90%, things aren't going to be running particularly well. Some small tables, it probably doesn't matter. They're so small that it's just going to walk through them anyway. So, you don't gain a lot by doing the index defragmentation. But the big tables, the ones you really care about, it's best to keep those pretty clean.
So if your SQL servers are rattling off the shelf, it's possibly that the indexes aren't very well structured.
So the reason it tends to happen more in Project and SharePoint, or it happens quite quickly in Project and SharePoint, and we sometimes get beaten up by the SQL engineers about some of this, is that we're inserting new random data into the pages. And if you've sort of looked in the databases or sometimes on the web pages in the URLs, you'll see these long sort of 32 character GUIDs with lots of O's and 1s and 2s and A's and B's and C's. And The problem is that they're pretty random. When you ask for a new GUID, it's a unique identifier, and they just come through randomly. So when you create a new task, for example, you create the GUID for that task, it needs to put that in the index. And it's not just adding it at the end because it's created it, and oh, perhaps it fits nearer the middle or at the beginning or whatever. So it's that design within SharePoint and project that means that the indexes can get fragmented pretty quickly. So what can we do? So setting a fill factor is important because that means that when you build an index, you're leaving some free space. So you've got some sort of wiggle room to be able to put the new index in, move things around without having to split that page, which is the expensive thing, where it's putting that data into two pages in the database rather than just having it into sort of one page. And then defragment regularly as required. So it's a little bit like bookshelves. And I was putting my slides together in my home office where everybody, of course, has a copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Who remembers books? Okay, books, good. I mean, if you don't remember books, just think of these as vinyl albums. Remember, well, CDs. Doesn't work with MP3s, the analogy breaks down a little bit. But so I've got a full bookshelf here, and I've got volume 18 that I need to stick in there. So, you know, I'm going to have to do something about that. Wouldn't it be better if I'd left some free space, and then I could have just sort of moved those ones up from 19 to 23 and put 18 in. So that's basically what we're talking about. The free space means we don't have to break that shelf up. It's probably a bit slower moving Encyclopedia Britannica onto a new shelf than it is actually moving it to data on a database, but you know, the database has to do it lots and lots and lots. So that's sort of the analogy that I like to think of as to make sense of, okay, I can see how that works. I'm going to have to shuffle those along. I said it gets better in 2013, and if you ever dive into the database, or in this case, I just added the column GUID to the sort of task form, and I just created six tasks in a row in 2010 on the top left and 2013 in the bottom right. And if you look at that, the top ones are totally random, and the bottom ones, it's only the first few characters that are changing, and we're getting all of the new stuff that we're creating is pretty much sequential. So both Project and SharePoint are starting to use the what are called sequential GUIDs. They're still unique, and they're far enough usually away from the other one that they're not going to. There's not going to be a clash, but they at least tend to index better because when you they're going to be together, and when you add a new one, it can go on the end. It makes my job a lot harder because I used to work with the old system, and if I was looking for a task in the database, and say it was task 4, then I'd pretty much only have to remember DO8E, and I could just look for that bit and I'd find it. But now in 2013, sometimes you have to sort of look further and longer to sort of find a unique bit, because you open it up and, well, they all look the same. Oh, yeah, there's a difference there, and you can sort of find that bit. So that's why things get a little bit better in 2013. Quite a bit better, depending how you create the tasks. I mean, I just did these one after the other. If you create five tasks today and then another two tomorrow, as you know, real life, so to speak, then you tend to find that you don't get quite as good a benefit as this. But it is certainly a step in the right direction. Read the manual. Now, the worst support cases, those where customers have been struggling for a while before they call us. And if they'd have just used a search engine, Bing, for example, then the answer was out there all the time. So it is worth looking online and sort of finding if the answer's already out there. We love talking to you all. I'm not saying don't call us, because I enjoy that. But you know, if you can find the answer yourself, then it can save you time as well. So that's a good place to look. There are some sort of good examples of this. We've got this DL internally. Called ProduSer within Microsoft. And you know, we ask questions of each other, and Ian will ask questions, and the various other partners will ask questions. And occasionally you'll get one that comes in, and they'll say something like, the subject is best practices on timesheet management on project plans. And then they sort of ask this question, has anybody got any best practices on project plan best practices? So I'd once replied to this after putting their subject line into Bing And it gave me the top hit back from Bing was the answer I was going to give them. So just trying to hint that, you know, they perhaps could have found that answer on their own. I do appreciate, though, that sometimes it's difficult to know what the right answer is when you find it. So obviously blogs, there's lots of good blogs out there, but it's a case of getting some idea of the reputation of the author to see whether you should trust it or not. If it's a forum question, then the forum answers generally, the answerer will have a number next to their name, and the bigger that number, the more likely that they have given you the right answer. Not a direct correlation. Sometimes even good people give bad answers. There's plenty of good stuff out there, so it's only worth having a look around.
Just to add to that, I try not to call Brian as much as I can do, but binging error messages is a really good thing to do. If you've got an error message, search on the string in the error message. You'd be amazed how much content will come up. And it can be very useful. It doesn't always be useful, but it's a really good place to start.
And when I'm writing blogs, I tend to sort of write them like that. So I'll do all the text stuff explaining what's going on and the pictures and everything else at the top. At the bottom, I'll usually just put the ULS log entries and all that kind of stuff, because you're not interested in reading it, but the search engines will have fun sort of putting all that stuff together. So I try and put all the error logs that are relevant to the problem in the blog posting, and then hopefully when you're searching for that particular error, something like the blog posting might come up. So custom fields, and this was a question from earlier about sort of slow publishing and that kind of thing. And we got some specific recommendations, particularly on task level formula-based fields, where even on the page in PWA, it says you shouldn't have more than 5 of these on a server. And we do mean server, so if you're hosting 3 PWAs on your server, then, you know, it's 5 between those 3. It's not sort of because if you've got lots of PWAs, obviously you might have lots of these, so it starts building up. I've got a great useful flow diagram on this one. My server is slow. Do you have lots of custom fields? Yes. Do you need them all? Yes. Is it still slow? Yes. Do you need them all? It may seem a bit sarcastic, but I'm English. But it's really, if you need them all and it slows your system down, then perhaps that's something you're going to have to put up with, or you have to look at how else you can speed things up. Do you need to beef up your SQL server so that those things will run a little bit faster? But, I mean, the more custom fields you have, particularly at the task level, some of that processing in publish will be quite slow. It really depends how often they're changed. So particularly if they're formula fields, then every time you open the plan, they tend to sort of get updated, and then they'll need to be saved again. So, you know, we've seen customers with lots of these, lots of tasks. Every time you're saving it, you're having to sort of push that data through again. So the answer, the other bit there, if you can't read it, do you have lots of custom fields? No. Then perhaps your DB needs some maintenance. So, you know, it's a pretty foolproof flow diagram. Help us to help you, repro steps. So you've got a problem. We need to fully understand exactly what that problem is so that we can know where we might need to look to sort that out. One thing that's got probably even more complicated with 2013, because we're a lot tighter integrated into SharePoint, we're making more use of the SharePoint task list, we've got SharePoint Designer, where we can go in and create a workflow and we can assign a task to somebody. And I've used task there probably 3 times, and I'm meaning something totally different each time. So when I say I've got a problem with this task, it could be one of a number of things. And the more you can give us, the quicker we can get started helping you. So, you know, if you've got we get some great cases in where you've done great documentation, a Word document that really sort of walks through it, gives us the screenshots, it's perfect. We can get a good start on that. Did you use a menu? Did you use the ribbon? One that Adrian mentioned earlier on, he was having a problem with a particular developer being able to repro his problem. Developer came to Adrian's office. Adrian's hot on keyboard shortcuts. The dev was using his mouse to do exactly the same thing. One reproed, one didn't. And then the logs as well. You know, get the logs ready for us. So whether it's the ULS, the application event, client-side logging, it's useful to have that ready so that you can get that to us and we can start sort of digging into that and working out what the problem is. This is a, something, again, we've got a best practice document for submitting and reporting on actual work. We made some changes December 2011, which really tied down the timesheets to be able to be the point of record of your entered time. So any reporting you're doing should be against the timesheet data, not so much the project data. The project data shouldn't change, but there are some potential times when the scheduling engine might start shuffling things around a little bit. You might see half an hour that should have been on one day suddenly finding itself the beginning of the following day, those kind of things. They're bugs. I mean, if you can repro those conditions, we'd love to fix those. But in the absence of that, the timesheet is the place to go. One problem you can get, and it's covered in that document, it tells you don't unpublish tasks. Because when you unpublish a task, the person who has that on a timesheet won't see it there anymore. Now, if the timesheet's been entered, submitted, approved, and all fine, nothing's going to happen to that data. You're not going to lose any data. But if the timesheet's still current, say the person's put their time in it, they've saved it, but they haven't submitted it, if you then unpublish the plan, that takes it out of certain tables where the timesheet is expecting it to be. So when you open the timesheet again, it says, doesn't seem to be there anymore. So you see that line disappear. So, and the problem with the line disappearing is it doesn't sort of disappear in front of their eyes, so they know about it. It's just gone. So they might forget that it was ever there, but they can't work out why they've only done sort of 30 hours work this week when they were sure they'd done 40, but where's that other 10 gone? Obviously, there's reasons people are doing that, and we need to understand what you're trying to achieve, and then we can normally suggest other ways of achieving the same kind of thing. So in single entry mode, when you open a timesheet, if the task isn't there, it'll get stripped out. And that's covered in the document as well. Patching. In the server, you're able to control what level of client can connect to the server. So if you know you've suffered from a particular bug which was fixed in the December CU, then by putting the version of the December CU in that field in server settings, that makes sure that nobody with an older version of the client can connect. They'll just get a message when they connect, which, my apologies, it's very cryptic and not very helpful, but you can sort of see that it's forget what the exact message is, but it's something to do with the WinProj version, not accepted, or something like that. We have fixed bugs in the client, but if you allow unpatched project professional to connect to the project server, bad things can happen. We had some issues in Save for Sharing where we were flipping the GUIDs. So if you did Save for Sharing and it came back again, then you would end up with new GUIDs for all of your assignments. Now, we fixed that, I don't know how long ago, years ago. But we still get cases coming up where somebody has connected to the server, not realized that their version's never been patched. It's just the original release of 2010. And they find out that they sort of hit that problem again. So if you control it on the server, then that means that you'll get some shouting from somebody who can't connect, but he won't connect and damage things. I point out on there on the slides where you can set that and put things right. Project Online, you don't get that control. And the other thing, the final point there, in the cumulative update release blogs, I generally give the versions. So I'll say that this version of the client will be reporting that it's this version. Don't get confused between the version of the patches and the version in the database. Somebody asked me the other day, they said, I patched it, but the version in the database didn't change. Should I go in and just edit it? No. The version in the database doesn't always get updated because it's like the schema version. If we release a cumulative update that doesn't change the database, then the version stays the same. So it doesn't always change, so that's not a problem if it doesn't. One thing to note there with 2013, because we've now got the same scheduling engine on the server as the client, PWA scheduling will also be affected by that version number. I don't expect that often to be a problem, but it was back in, I think, October, where we had on the server scheduling engine like a couple of sort of fourth place decimals were different from the client version. So you'd protect to the specific client version, and then you'd try and edit a project in PWA, and it would fail, and in the logs, you'd get the same error that you'd see in PWA, in a project professional, the incorrect WinProj version or something like that. So patching is great, but you really want to make sure you're controlling the unpatched bits as well. And planning, well, I think this is probably one where I hand over to Ian and Peter to talk more about planning.
Okay, so now to Peter. So that's the sorts of issues that Brian sees in support. And now Peter is going to talk about the sorts of things he sees during the deployment process.
Yes. So thank you, Brian. I would say that the majority of what I'm about to talk about is also technical. But at the same time, it's not that that we, as a partner, do something wrong often, because we do. We also need to follow your guidance and so on and keep us updated. But the majority of what I'm about to show is what I see that happens when the customers take over, typically, the operational activities when dealing with Project Server. The guidelines or the headers for what I'm about to talk to is, first of all, the user experience. Sorry, like this. Meaning that I've seen a tremendous amount of money being spent on doing creative BI. There's a lot of budget for that often. But when it comes down to the end users having to type in data, we go for just the standard or the default, because it's just cheaper to do training, we follow the guidance and so on. And it's just, I'm gonna come back to why that is a problem, in fact. Secondly, I've heard so many people here loving the task constraints. We laugh at it because it is nice, and it's always nice to do when you plan your project, but once your project is running, it's not that nice. So how to do, you know, similar activity planning that can still give you the milestones or the deadlines or the transparency, but making it simple is something I just want to show two screenshots of. Master projects, yes or no. Some people love it, some don't. Those who often love it are also good at VBA and other stuff. So I'm going to come back to that. OData, Project Online Reporting for, capabilities, for some people have turned out to be, surprisingly slow. But maybe it's not OData. Maybe it's because the way of connecting data and dragging and pulling data down to your spreadsheets. Wrong use of RPS, or the resource breakdown structure. What is it? Is it for managing competencies? Many of you might do that. In my case, or in my head, it's not. So a conclusion on that one as well. OLAP cubes, you might know it, you might not know it. I hope you know about it. But I've seen customers who have been, you know, working with Project Server for many years and do not know what OLAP cubes is. And that's a shame. And client performance also. So my client is acting slow. I'm saving projects. It might be something related to what you told us, Brian, the custom fields, whatever. But it also sometimes is something completely different and more simple. So that's more or less what I have to do, except for the final one, which is slow PWA, slow project web app, or client performance as a general. So the first one, the user experience. As I told you just before, in the top right corner, you can see kind of like how much money we are willing to invest typically in BI compared to the UI or the experience for the users. And it's quite funny because I believe that the amount of users accessing the reports that you do, sometimes it's like 5% of the total amount of users. So we give something really, really nice to the 5%, and for the rest, go for standard. And if you want to get nice data in to do your nice reporting on, you need to make it attractive to be there. And promoted links and other stuff in Project Server that's now available is a nice feature, but you can do it even more custom. So the fix in my head is, to begin with, spend the same amount of money on the BI as you would on the UI. It might necessarily not mean that you have to find new budget, just reduce the budget for BI and even it out a little bit. So instead of going for 3D in your pie chart, go for two-dimensional or whatever. Maybe that's enough. So the fix, create an attractive portal, front page might even. Use simple tools to do it. PowerPoint could be a way to do it. You can use something called Image Maps, which is free. It's a free tool online that can actually allow for you to have your image, PNG, JPEG, whatever, and add zones directly to it. So in order for you to create a front page that looks attractive, you just need to know how to do an image, and then add some text, create project, whatever. I'm going to show you an example later. And without knowing any code, just say, this zone should go to this page, this zone to this page, etc. It's kind of easy. Even your graphical designers in that department could do it themselves. And then you deploy the UI to the PWA front page, and obviously also put on the PDPs or the subpages or whatever, the reports and so on, so it has the same kind of look and feel all over. To learn it, there was actually a session, unfortunately, yesterday, on how to do this. It's the PC261 session code. So there's a video on that, I think, tomorrow, you know, by the end of the week, that you can download and see exactly how to do this without being a developer. As an example, this is actually a draft we made for a Danish bank. And this is actually a way that it could look, the PWA, the front page. And what you see here is an image made in PowerPoint with some other images just added to that picture in PowerPoint, saved as one big picture, and just some zones added later on. So if you click here, you go somewhere, you click here, and so on. And if you have multiple target user profiles that needs different UIs when they enter the same PWA address, you just add a target audience profile to that web part holding the image, and you do the same for the rest of the images, so it goes to the same page. So you can do it really simple, no code needed. And the users love it, I would say. At least that's been our experience as well. They will know they got something new. They didn't just get the upgrade of Project Server to the next release, they got something completely new. So moving ahead, task constraints everywhere. Don't make the client behave more complex than you actually need, even though it's nice to do these waterfall planning efforts and linking everything together. It might not be necessary, especially not when you run the project, because often it will not go as planned. Here's just because these slides were made so you could just, you know, print them out later on and reuse them as inspiration. But up here you'll see a project that, or a phase in a project that I've chose to call, it's not going to happen like that. We analyze something, we code something, we test something, we do some debugging, we release, we have a milestone. And from the books, it should be done in that direction, on that order. But sometimes people have a tendency to start here and so on. And if they do, and if they have single entry mode enabled, and if they do it through a timesheet, it's just going to mess up your whole plan in a way that you didn't expect. But the reason to why I think many people do this is because they want to track the milestone or the delivery date for this phase. And if they try to remove all these links and instead add the milestone directly to the phase, project, the client will say, you cannot do that. Your milestones, if you want to connect them to anything, needs to be added or to the phase at to the same level as you are linking it to. So down here you have an example where the milestone on, from a VBS perspective is at the same level, meaning the first one, as the phase. So you can link them directly together. And then this one, or all the tasks within, can more or less be managed manually if you prefer that. And you will still capture the latest end date of the end of the latest task, thereby allowing you to actually get the milestone. So you get the same information as up here, but obviously in this way, it's not linked together. But finally, also from this perspective, tracking it. So if you make a baseline on it, you'll still be able to track the same changes that has happened throughout the project, even though it's done like this. So the fix, again, in my opinion, it's subjective, I would say. I would put milestones or major key milestones on the same level as the phases, link that together, and have project managers do whatever they want in between. I would also set phases to auto-schedule. Otherwise, you're going to have phases that are shorter than the amount of tasks below the phase. So phases and milestones always automatic. Everything in between, manual, auto, it's up for the PM to decide. And then use baselines to track. I've seen people who have worked with project for many, many years, almost since the first version, who never really knew that they could do the same things like I just did here. So a little lesson for some to learn. Problem number three, master projects, yes or no? How many of you think you have to do master projects in Project Server? How many of you see it as a necessity? That's okay, good. One? Okay. Yes, turn it on.
So please raise your hands if you use master projects on the server. Hey. There we go. So about 10 or 15% yes. Of the audience here.
Yeah. And do you like doing that? Do you think it's easy to manage or maintain? Or does it give you? No, I just see the heads going like this. In my opinion, going back to why many people tend to do multi-projects into the same project, it's also because they have the role of a program manager, being responsible for the sum of other projects. But if you read, which I guess many of you have, the books or the theories, from it could be Prince 2 or PMI, doesn't really matter, on what the roles is for a project manager, what the role has to do with. It's not changing anything in other people's projects. I would hate it personally if I were a project manager and some program manager just completely rearranged my project for the next day. So in my head, at least, and also in other theoretical books about it, it's about managing the sum of what goes on within your program from a strategic perspective, budget perspective, and so on, not from a task perspective necessarily, maybe the major milestones. So the fix in my head is thinking of program or portfolio managers, which could be the same thing as somebody who needs to do some reporting on the sum of some activities related to different projects. And you don't need to do a master project in a client to do that, especially not if you have the server. You can use the new reporting tools in the new client or the 2013 client and gain the same insights as you would have had by doing a regular master project. I'm going to give you an example on that. If we open up the PWA, it could look like this. In this case, we've grouped some projects by the owner. It could be grouped in any ways. For portfolio managers, a portfolio is not a static thing. Today, a portfolio could be 7 projects. Next week, it's 9. Or we split it up so it's 10. Whereas if I'm a program manager, it's more static. It's the same pile of projects that I'm managing. But if you wanted to have a report based on these 4 projects, you could just hold control down and open these projects in project, still using the client. And what it actually does is that it's creating right now in the background. Maybe I should have refreshed the page. That's going to come. It's going to load those projects into a temporary master project. So we're still doing a master project, but just for this moment. And once it's done loading the projects into the client, when we release the project, there is no project. There is no master project. We just do it temporarily to capture what goes on. Because that's the responsibilities I have. So now when it's done, and right now it's just complaining about a start date, that's all right. We'll get the 4 projects we selected eventually. Yes, here. So you have your temporary master project. It has no name because it's not a project. It's just for reporting purposes. You can obviously drill down if you want to see what goes on. Normally you wouldn't care except for the milestones. You could choose them all, add them to a timeline and do that if you wanted to, and trim the Gantt chart to fit the stuff you have to do reporting on. But you could also use, just go with the mouse, the reporting capabilities that are brand new and very attractive in my head to look at. Do the summary of what goes on, which is across all the projects. Do a report on the resources, for instance, like this. So this is all the projects that we're looking at the same time. Do a report on, for instance, the cash flow, which is a very nice report for a program manager. But without having to go through every project or creating this master project. So that's just one simple way of showing you that you can actually do master projects without doing the old-fashioned way of having master projects.
How many of you have done this before? About half. 25. No, not even that. Yeah. How many? Is that useful? Those of you who haven't seen it, good thing? Good. I love it, personally. I think it's great. It came as quite a shock when Peter showed it to me for the first time.
All right. So I would use Project Center to the place where you create these temporary master projects, and I would use the client reporting tools to actually do the reporting. That's more or less it. Problem number 4, it takes minutes before my simple report is refreshed in online. So this has to do with OData, and it has to do with how to actually do a report. OData is some sets of data that you connect to as a feed or as an RSS subscription almost, and you pull data into the client, for instance. When you have to trim your OData connections, there's many ways of doing it. Complex tools, but you could also just use Notepad to select the data you need. If you have a custom field called Total Budget 2018, if you want that to be included in your OData, you can just add that name into the OData connection file by using Notepad. But the problem is I've seen many people not doing that. Instead, they go for the Select All statement. I want all data so my OData report can do all the pivoting tables that I need. I have all the information. Problem is, it's then pulling every data out every time you refresh maybe a very simple report. So it's actually just an example of how it actually looks. You have a select statement, and you can then write the names of the fields you would like to look at in your report. As an example, this report, if you wanted to have this on some web page somewhere, pulling it from OData, Project Online, what you would need only is the project name, the custom field called risk. It wouldn't be risk, actually, because that's protected, I think, but something else, risk 2. Complexity, if that's a custom field, and the total cost you set up. And that's the only four, you know, fields you would need and add to your select statement. And then that project or that report would load in seconds rather than minutes. So you trim it, and the way to do it is, first of all, I would say pull out all the data, create the report the way you want it to, and then remove all the stuff you don't need. It's kind of simple, and you don't need to be a developer to do it. So just avoid the select all stuff, because that's not a good way to do it. Number 5, no control of who can see what. I've seen many people setting up so many categories or groups per project, because it's a secret project and stuff like that, which is quite all right sometimes. But often it's also because the RBS structure used for managing resources is not set up. Many use it to just set up competencies, because they want to track the usage of those competency groups when doing simulations, for instance, in the portfolio area. And when you set up portfolio simulations, you have to answer to the setting around where can we find accumulated information on our resources. And many would say, go to the RBS. And then they think competencies all of a sudden. The point is that if you want to use it, in my head, the right way, the fix is actually to map your organization or the hierarchy of your organization into the RBS structure. The RBS structure is telling you who is the manager of who and who is allowed to see what based on those relationships. And if you set it up, which can take some time, because many of you might have it kind of difficult to set up the organization, especially because many of you might know that once you're done, the organization has changed. So who's going to manage that? In my head, that's master data that should be stored in the, for instance, HR system, wherever you have that, SAP, whatever. So it should be the HR division's responsibility to maintain that hierarchy or that setting, and you just pull it in or synchronize it into your RBS structure. That would be my way of doing it. It should not be up to the PMO to manage the RBS or the organizational structure. It shouldn't be, but sometimes it is. So use it to map who belongs to who. In this case, my company could work in Denmark and Sweden. We have consulting and developers, which are two different teams. And if you were to set that up from an RBS perspective, projection would be the number one level, Denmark, the second level, and Sweden as well, where, for instance, Brian Smith could be the manager of Denmark, and I could report to Brian because I'm in consulting. And somebody could report to me because they are beneath consulting or in my team. In this way, if I were sitting here, I could only see what goes on within my team, nothing else. Brian could see what goes on in consulting and development, and whoever is up here could see all of it. So from a reporting perspective, from a project center view, resource center view, whatever, you could use that information to just make sure that nobody will see more than they are allowed to, rather than creating 250 user groups to track that. Maybe that's a question worth asking as well. How many of you have set up the RBS like this? That's 10% maybe. How many of you are using the RBS? So it could be fun. Thank you. That's the rest of you. It could be fun later on to know about, we have the mic open, what you use it for, actually. Can I come back to that, maybe? So problem number 6, OLAP Cubes, a new game. I've seen many places where the business, meaning the end users, they have no idea of what it is. They request the report. It's being built by SQL. Now I heard that reporting services is coming back again. That's nice. But still, it requires coding skills, and the business don't have that. And every time I ask you, why haven't you been introduced to the cubes? Do you know what it is? You can connect to it from your spreadsheets, and still they haven't seen it. And sometimes they've been working with Project Server for like 7 years. And we've had those cubes around, I think, all the way back to 2003, right? So it's not, not something new, but I think for the IT department, sometimes it's kind of tricky to enable those cubes. It's not that easy to deploy them, actually. You need to set something up correctly. And for this reason, there are guidelines, but there's also the Brian way to do it, which is more or less like a summary of the steps you need to follow. And if you follow these, you can have those cubes up and running. So that's the link to that. But besides just getting them up and running, you need to understand that there are 11 different ones. Some of them are only for timesheet data, some are for project non-time phase, project time phase, and so on. And you can also merge them and you can do MDX on them to add or extend the calculations. You can use department fields to control the access and so on. So again, I would say a quick question maybe before I say anything. How many of you are using the cubes? Okay, that's half of you. How many have never heard about the cubes? Okay, that's only like, that's okay. No, that's 3 or 4% of you maybe. So that's okay. So many of you have heard about it, but you don't use it. In my head, if I'm working on premise, I couldn't see why I would not use them at all, but that's something else. So it's kind of easy to deploy them once you know how, which is up here, and then you can more easy, I would say, train the business to doing the reports themselves rather than them having to request it from IT because it's a SQL code. Number 7, bad client performance. I've had also a lot of support because after we deploy, people call us and say, once I hit save, it takes like 10 minutes. Maybe project is slow. Why haven't you improved that performance and so on? And when I go there, which is unfortunately sometimes weeks after the support case started, when I go, I found out that the laptop looks like this and haven't been changed for the last 10 years.
Why have you got my laptop there?
which is a shame, because you're doing massive calculations on thousands of rows, if that's the project you're running, requires brain power, not just from a personal perspective, but also from a computer perspective. And if you're running 64-bit, which many are actually, you need 2 gigabytes of RAM at minimum to make it function just, you know, on average. Many laptops I've seen have 2 gigabytes of RAM. They might have 4 if they're lucky, and also a slow processor sometimes. So, but if you have big plans and if you have a lot of other stuff, not custom fields because that's server-side, but if you have a big plan and you need to do a lot of calculations, it takes time if your computer is slow, and that's just the basic need to know. So not having a machine that exceeds the requirements, it's just going to have you hanging, and it has nothing to do with the project client at all. So for me, it's kind of simple, and it's like giving the worst tool to the most professional guy that needs to go out and do his job. You know? So it shouldn't be that difficult in my head to give a nice computer. But
it's worthwhile mentioning that some of the recommendations in the TechNet against project server and the clients are the minimums.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, they're not the ones you deploy. They're the minimums. So, you know, look at them, and if it says minimum, probably you need a bit more than what it said in there, okay? So just take it and use this information sensibly.
Yeah, but I'm not sure the CIO translated in the same way as you do.
Absolutely.
It's a cost saver. What's the cost?
Don't tell them. Tell them that you what you need to have.
You should write the maximum. Then.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Number 8, slow PWA client performance due to not knowing about custom field limitations. I've seen so many customers, and this is like a big thing for me because it's almost every time. 100 plus, 200 plus, 300 plus custom fields being set up in the PWA, and all of a sudden it goes slow, strangely enough. Many of them on task level with calculated fields, so this task plus this field plus this one equals something else, and you have 10,000 tasks, you have a slow PC, and the whole thing just goes crazy. There are limitations to how many custom fields you can use, and that has to do with your server farm sizing. Same as with the client. There is a fix called upgrade to 2013 or online because it's just better. But for those of you who are still stuck with 2010 for some time to come yet, I would say don't use custom fields to time phase your project data because that's normally what I see. Because we need to track a report on quarters, month, or whatever, we have to create a custom field called total cost, month 1, 2014, month 2, 2014, month 3, 2014, etc., which gives you just all of these crazy fields. And you can't delete them because you need them for reporting purposes as well. It's just going to grow. We have UMT, we have SharePoint, we have even us, we have an app for this as well. There's multiple out there, Brightworks as well, doing add-ons that can do this, that can time phase your custom fields. And then you just send the totals or whatever you need back to Project Server to make your Project Center look good and have some information. But the smaller calculations or the time phasing don't use the custom fields to do that. Know your server farm size and play by the rules. How many of you know the size of your server, if it's a small, medium, or large one? Okay, that's 5% again. It's kind of important before you set up your system and do recommendations. It's kind of like the most important, which is why it's scary when I ask the PMO who's in charge of setting it up, what's your server size? We don't know. IT just provided it, and then we just set something up. So again, there is a blog. This is my blog, but that's also an official guidance from Microsoft, and the official one looked like this. This is for 2010. I know it's very small, so I just highlighted this one. If you have more than 20 risks totally in your environment, you cannot go for a small farm. And I haven't, if people are using risks, they have more than 20 risks, obviously. But if you go to a large one, you're gonna have 20,000, that might be enough, unless you have a risky business. But this is showing exactly how many fields you could have. It's recommendations, so you could just avoid it and ignore it. And then you'll end up calling you, and you have to troubleshoot why it's slow, and you'll end up finally concluding that you have 8 RAM to support the whole thing. You have one server instead of 3, and so on. So this is showing exactly, from a very detailed perspective, more detailed actually than in 2010, how many PDPs, how many stages, how many phases, how many workflows, etc. And the funny part, some of them, from a small perspective, are blank. That's the scary part, right? So workflows, don't do that. Average project per workflow, no phases, no, and so on. So, and still I see so many having a small server farm. So this is worth knowing. It's worth printing this out, going to your IT department, and then showing what you have today, and have them size it right. We have a free app available also right now in the marketplace. So if you have 2013, you can add it. It's called PWA Statistics. We just built this for this reason. It pulls out these information so you don't have to find out yourself. You print it, you print this, and you go to your IT department. So you can download that. I think that was actually... no, it wasn't mine. I have one more. Good. PMs complain about the project client being too complex. It can be for many reasons. But one of them I've seen is that you go for, again, going for standard. We just take standard and we send them to a basic training course. When you take the basic or the default training courses for your project managers and you don't train them in what they should know based on your governance, that's kind of like the hardest way to do it, in my opinion. They have to learn about all the features or the functions within Project the Client, even though the company or the organization as a whole is only asking for maybe 5 fields when you create your project, 2 fields for running it, 3 fields for closing it. Views can be used to fix this. I would say, and I sometimes do, delete all the default views and start all over. What do you need to know? We need to have something where we do a create of a project, when we initiate it, when we plan it. We need these things. When we run it, we need this. When we monitor it, when we close it, we need this. And when maturity is very low, I would say 3 views, like create, track, and close, might be enough. And training that the end users are going to need are how to use those 3 views, and not project the client as a whole. That's up for round 2 when the maturity has increased just a little bit. That's actually some good blogs around this as well, how to create these views. But here's an example where I just completely removed all the default views, and it's left now with a create view, where the only thing I'm asking the business is, please define your tasks. Don't care about duration, just care about work, because we are selling hours or whatever. Don't care about start or finish, we call it deadlines. And then add a note every time you have something. That could be a way to start. And the training would be kind of easy. If you don't understand what this is, just, you know, out of the view as a general, you might have another problem. So it's just, it's more easy than saying, we have the enterprise Gantt chart, we have the tracking Gantt chart, we have this Gantt chart, we have another Gantt chart, we have another one, and we have you can split it even, you have track usage, you have, and all those stuff. You know, you can just completely avoid that in my head by going for the simple, going for what the business need, remove the rest, and do training only on these views instead. That was my 9 issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, it's the closing stretch now, okay? I'll go through as quickly as I can do. Okay, so what we're going to cover off are a whole bunch of different issues, and I basically just headlined them here. I won't go through them on this slide. We'll just show them what they are. And they're somewhat cryptic, because that, as was described by Brian, is the British sense of humor. We can't help doing things in a way that isn't terribly obvious. So let's have a look at this. Failure to plan means plan to fail, okay? People get really excited when they start up and they've made a decision to deploy project server or project online. And the problem is that they rush off and they're sort of like, we've made a decision, let's deploy, off we go. Start configuring it, guys. We don't really know what we're doing, but we're going to go ahead anyhow. It's no good. You've got to treat the deployment of project server or project online just the same way as you will run any other project. And I can promise you that does not happen. Okay? You have to cure yourselves before you can cure other people. Are we all on the same page? So what happens is somebody has control of the selection of the project solution, but they haven't involved the users or the other parts of the business. And so what you get are bits of the business that use it and other bits of the business saying, well, we didn't choose it. It wasn't our selection. We didn't have nothing to do with it at all. And the reality is, during that selection phase, everybody has to be involved. They all have to be bought in, because if it's going to be effective, everybody has to be engaged and using the system. Expression in English, more haste, less speed. Okay. We've chosen the, we're going to go through Project Server, and we've built a plan. And the plan is for to do everything all at once. We're going to do demand management. We're going to do portfolio analysis. We're going to do timesheeting. We're going to do everything all at once. And we've never done it before, but we'll cope. And the reality is that what happens is that we get so focused on the delivery dates without real understanding of how long it's going to take us to do it, that the frustration with the system and the ability not to actually deliver on time becomes prevalent. And then the worst thing happens is we don't tell anybody. We don't tell people that we're having a problem. We sort of hide it. And then the senior management starts saying, well, hey, you promised us you're going to have this all singing or dancing solution. Where is it? You're already 3 months late. You're a PMO. What sort of PMO are you? You can't even get your own systems running properly. So being realistic, not rushing, doing things in, you know, everybody's done time management, elephant tasks. You have to eat the elephant one bit at a time. You can't eat it all at once. Short-term gain, long-term pain. Quick decisions are often good, but quick decisions without any forethought can be really poor. And one of the things that we know very clearly, for example, is we make a decision today, we might live to regret it in 6 months' time. And those of you who may be around Office 365 or doing Project Online will know that test domain that you set up is suddenly the domain that you're stuck with for your organization is probably not a very good idea. So again, you know, think very carefully before you make any choices, because some of them are going to be really significant and have a major impact further on down the line. Knowledge does not travel through osmosis. I'm sure you all know what osmosis is, and the reason why we're talking to you and showing you all these things is because if we don't talk to you about it, you'll never know. And the problem is that when we deploy the system, and it's a bit relevant to the slide that Peter just said, we absolutely do not invest enough in getting people to adopt. There are two things that you need when you're deploying project management inside an organization, in each hand. In one of them is a carrot, and in the other one is a stick. And if you don't have the carrot and the stick, if you just have a stick, it won't work. If you just have a carrot, it won't work. You need both of those things. And every organization will have different carrots and different sticks they need to use. But if you haven't got them, people will just fall back into those old lazy ways of doing things. So remember that. It's really, really important. And then what happens, of course, is as people fall back into the old system, your reports, all those things people are using to track what's going on, they start to become inaccurate. Management lose faith in the system. The system falls into disrepair. If only we had thought of that before we started. If only we actually realized why we're doing this. What is the objective? Is the objective to run projects more efficiently? Yes. How do you measure that? What is that measure at the end of the day to say we're doing a better job? Maybe it's utilization. Maybe we can show that instead of having 60% utilization of our resources, we've now got 70% of our utilization of our resources. And boy, if you can show that to the management, they're going to support your next project that you're going to do, because you can show profitability back to the organization or reduce costs, depending on what you're trying to do. But you really need to ensure that where you're starting is where you want to go to, and that all the things, if you suddenly are 3, 4, 5, a year down the line, people say, well, actually, we didn't really want to do that. What we wanted to do was this. You know, the cost of changing a system halfway through its life is substantial normally. Demarcation. Okay. I've got to be very careful here. I don't think there's anybody in this organization from one of the organizations I was working with. But they spent 2 years trying to decide whether they wanted to have one single PWA with everything divided up by departments, or multiple PWAs with every different department having their own PWA, and then how do we report against all of it? And it went from backwards and forwards between the enterprise architects and the IT and the PMO, trying to work out where they want to go. 2 years later, they had not moved on at all, because nobody had really said, sorry, we've talked about this long enough, that's the decision we're going to make. Now, I said, don't make fast decisions, but don't make no decisions. Sometimes you have to say, this is the route we're going to, and we will live with some of the restrictions that go with it. We have the time and the skills. Oh, I hate this. We're the IT department. We know everything. We can deploy this for you. It's not a problem. Sorry. Well, we're busy working on something else right now. We'll get back to it next week. Well, no, actually, we've got a new project that's taken priority over your project. And suddenly, time has moved on and you've got nowhere. They don't understand how to structure it. It's not like an ERP system. It's an EPM system. Oh, I don't understand it. What's it all about? It's different. So my view on that is bring in external subject matter experts. Bring in partners. Help you get these things up and running as quickly as possible in a structured and knowledgeable way. We've got fantastic resources amongst our partners. I'm sure many of you have been downstairs into the exhibition area and talked to the guys there. Use them. They've invested huge amounts of their time and their skills building up this knowledge of body of knowledge, the Microsoft body of knowledge. Use it. So with that, we will invite Q&A. So I went really quickly through my slides to try and get ourselves back on track. Anybody would like to ask a question? There's going to be 5 minutes of questions at that microphone there. Stand up and be counted. Gentlemen, all right, first one. No, he's walking away. Bye-bye. Introduce yourself, sir.
Hi, I'm Jerry. You mentioned about the number of task level fields, custom fields that have formulas. Is there a best, if you're in that situation, is there a best practice for eliminating them, since you already have this data that's published out there on all the schedules? Many of them are old schedules.
It's a good question. You're over the limit, but do you still need those fields, or are you sort of going to live without them? You decided you can sort of break away?
Both.
Both, right, okay. I think it's just got to bite the bullet and sort of trim them down and sort of clear out from those plans. I mean, once you obviously delete them from the enterprise side, another way of potentially getting that same data is through external means. So potentially if they're calculated at the task level, you could do it in reporting. SQL Server reporting services might be able to create some calculated fields for you. I've seen some imaginative use of SharePoint lists. So rather than have stuff that's in project, not so much at the task level, but at the project level, you might have a SharePoint list that has lots of other metadata that relates to the individual projects. So there's quite a few other ways of sort of moving on from that problem and sort of getting past it.
We have orphaned information out in your schedule?
You shouldn't be orphaning any information. I'm just trying to... I mean, obviously, if you're deleting a field that another calculated field is based on, then you've got to sort of take those kind of things into consideration. But if you're deleting those fields, there's not really any... And it's only going to be other custom fields that would have references to them. So you do have to be careful. You have to know where you're using them.
Sounds like a project to me. You have to sit down and think about it and then plan for it and then test it and do all those things that you should do, which is best practice, frankly, as opposed to worst practice, which is what you've got at the moment. Any more questions? Sir? We'll just take one more after that, and if you want to ask another question, just stand behind that gentleman.
My name is Nathan. You mentioned something about sometimes in time collection, half days here or not half days there, that may perhaps is a problem. I don't know if this is related, but if you have people working on many different time zones and they're all collaborating, what's the best practice? When you said it's due on the 21st, is it 21st in the States? Is it 21st in Europe? Is it 21st in China? How do you define that?
That's a very good point, and I think it's something that I've got customers in Europe who are running across multiple time zones. There isn't a best practice as such, but I would actually recommend that you put in a time zone custom field in there to record which time zone your tasks, your resources are working in, so at least you can visually understand what's going on. But the reality is we don't track that within the system, so the potentially of, you've got somebody in New Zealand, you're working today and they're working tomorrow, is a sort of interesting situation, and you have to think about that. But I think project managers are used to that because this has been a problem that's been around for many years. But there isn't a best practice as such for that. But I would keep a track within the resource record. I'll add a customer field in for time zone if you're worrying about that, so you could see. And there's no calculation required, so it's not a problem. Okay, we'll close at that point in time because you want to get ready for the party. I'd like to thank you all for being here. Fill out your evaluations. Enjoy the rest of the conference. Have a great evening. Get completely smashed.